You are listening to The Point from MC3 in Lewistown, Pennsylvania. Check us out on the web at mc3church.org or find us on Facebook at mc3church. MC3, it's like nothing you'd expect.
So the problem with teaching second or third's even worse. The problem with teaching second is the first guy can take a lot of your ideas as to what you want to do. So we're going to do it anyway. Last week, Kirk started off with a trivia game about superheroes. Today, I'm a little bit more spiritual than Kirk. So we're going to do a trivia game about Genesis. How many of each kind of animal did Moses take on the ark? First one. Two? None. Oh, you got to get up pretty early in the morning. Okay. Now you got to stay on your toes here, right? So the second question. How old was Noah when he finished the ark? 600 years old. We'll learn that. We'll learn that a little bit later on, but that's good. That was more of the difficult ones. Third one. How long did it take Noah to build the ark? 100? 150. Actually, the Bible doesn't tell us. The only thing that alludes to anything about how long it took him to build the ark, some people say it took 40 to 60 years. Some say 120. And the way they get to 120 is in Genesis 6:3 it says, "Then the Lord said, My spirit will not contend with humans forever, for they are mortal. Their days will be 120 years." Now, that verse can be interpreted a number of different ways. Some people take that to mean it took Noah 120 years to build the ark. We're fairly sure it's somewhere between 60 and 120, somewhere in there. How many people were on the ark? Close.
Eight.
I got this one right here. Eight. That would be Noah and Joan and the three sons and their wives. Right? Good. How many windows were on the ark?
One.
It's at least one. It talks in the Bible about when Noah opened the window to let the birds out. So there's at least one. But there may have been more. But we'll go with one on that one. How long were they on the ark? I calculated it, along with Google, to 377 days. They were on the ark for quite a long time. And I think we have the last one here. How many rudders are on the ark? None. There are no rudders on the ark. What does that symbolize to us? God is in control. Noah could not steer that thing where he wanted to go. That ark was just a floating vessel, and it went wherever God wanted it to go. So that sort of brings us into the mindset of Noah, sort of get an idea of how much we know, how much we don't know. You guys know pretty good. So let's start into some background stuff. Once again, so we notice if you started reading the Bible from the beginning, you're going to start off with Genesis 1. Genesis 1 and 2 are all a story about the creation of the world. And then we go to the fall. Genesis 3 is basically about the fall. Hopefully we know something about that. If we don't, I'm sure we will cover that in a future lesson. But Genesis chapter 3 is the fall. And then Genesis chapter 4, Cain and Abel. We got a very good description of Genesis chapter 4 last week, talking about Cain and Abel. And then we got Genesis chapter 5, and that's basically a genealogy of everybody between Adam and Noah. Now, how many chapters are in the Bible? Does anybody know? I didn't know this. I had to Google this too. 1,189 chapters in the Bible. So if you're reading this book called the Bible, and you were going to go through, you have to read 1,189 chapters to get through it. But what we find out is by chapter 6, God is fed up with everything. God is ready to wipe everybody out. By chapter 6, in a book that went 1,189 chapters. Okay, so I think that was pretty interesting. So what we find out whenever we read Genesis chapter 5, with the genealogies, is that there are 9 generations between Adam and Noah. That's why you would call, if you were Noah, you'd say, "I was my great, 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 great grandpappy Adam." 9 generations. There are 1,656 years between Adam and Noah. And there are only 9 generations in there. That's pretty amazing. That's like If we were to assume a generation in our day and age is like 30 years, 30 year for a generation, that'd be more than 55 of our generations. But there's only 9 generations between Adam and Noah. That'd be like if we wanted to see who our ancestors were 1,656 years ago, that'd take us all the way back to 357 A.D. 357, it's just 357 years after Christ was on the earth. That's whoever our ancestors were back then, that's the kind of same in relation to Adam to Noah, or Noah to Adam, as us to our ancestors back in 357. It was a long period of time in those first 6 chapters. Actually, between chapters 4 to 6, they just skips over, 1,600 years there. So we don't know a whole lot about it. But what we do know about it, we'll get into that a little bit later. If you read Genesis chapter 5, you're going to notice things like, so-and-so had a boy named so-and-so at the age of 120, or at the age of 95, or something like that. They didn't have kids until they were, most of the time, above 100. Before they started having kids. I started thinking that's probably a pretty good idea. By that time, you'd be pretty mature enough to be able to handle kids. Laughter. Okay. So, they didn't have kids till they were over 100. Noah didn't have his kids until what age? 500. Noah was 500 years old before he had his first children. Some estimated that there might have been up to 10 billion people on the earth in the days, at the time that Noah was on the earth, 10 billion. Of course, we weren't there. We don't know for sure. The estimates are anywhere between, what do I have here? 100 million to 10 billion. There were a lot of people. How many people are on the earth today? 7 billion. Yep, 7 billion is what I found. Yep, 7 billion is what we have on the earth today. There could have been even more people on the earth back in the days of Noah than there are today. Grandpappy Methuselah. Who's Methuselah? What do we know him for? Oldest man in the Bible. So, oldest. How old was Methuselah when he died? 969 years old, right. 969 years old. Let's talk a little bit more about Methuselah, because this is really interesting when I started looking into this. Grandpappy Methuselah. So, Methuselah was Noah's grandpappy, okay? So, as Kirk mentioned, if you're a real teacher, you have to have some Hebrew words that we got to teach you. And I'm going to teach you what Methuselah meant. In Hebrew, it's a Hebrew word for before the deluge, or it could also mean, other translations mean, his death shall bring judgment. That's pretty interesting to call your son before the deluge, or his death shall bring judgment. I don't think we have any names like that anymore. But so I started looking into that a little bit more. Did you know? And you can actually do this by looking in Genesis 5. Genesis 5, 26 through 28. Methuselah died the same year as the flood. And like I said, you can calculate this. I think that's the next slide. I have some math up here. So if you look in 5, 26 through 28, we know Methuselah was 969 years old, right? Now, if we count down how many days he had till he died, we also know that he had his son, Lamech, whenever he was 187 years old. So that means he had 782 more years to live after he had his son Lamech. Lamech had Noah whenever he was 182. So if you subtract 782 from 182, you get 600. And how old was Noah when the flood happened? 600. So Methuselah died the same year that the flood happened. And whoever his parents were knew that was coming, because they named him that 969 years earlier. And I thought that was pretty cool. Also, Methuselah lived for 250 years while Adam was still alive. Adam was still alive for 250 years while Methuselah was alive. That means Methuselah could, like, ask Adam, what was it like to be created? You know, what was it like to wake up and you're there? You know, things like, do you have a belly button? How about, so, great, 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 great grandpappy Adam, was that apple really good? No, you can't talk about that, Methuselah. You can't be talking about that. That's no good. But that would be pretty cool to be able to talk to Adam. So that means Noah actually could talk to Methuselah, who talked to Adam, and get some really cool stories. I mean, those stories, if you had grandparents that were maybe in the war, they had some pretty cool stories. But it's going to be pretty hard to top the stories that Adam would have about, you know, things like naming the animals and being in a place where there was perfection. And the lion laid down with the lamb. Just all that kind of stuff would be really cool. All, and by the way, we have that to look forward to here in the future. And just in case you didn't know that, we will be returning to that Eden state. But anyway, so that's Methuselah. I think I told you to have him, Methuselah. So now let's introduce ourselves to the population or to the society that Noah lived in. The Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. This is in Genesis chapter 6. The Lord regretted that he had made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled. So the Lord said, I will wipe from the face of the earth the human race I have created, and with them the animals, the birds, and the creatures that move along the ground, for I regret that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. That's a pretty significant statement right there. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. So let's talk a little bit about Noah. We know what kind of society he was in. What do we know about Noah? Well, we don't know a whole lot about Noah. We have a couple things that we know. We know he was a righteous man. How do we know this? In Genesis 6, chapter 9, it says, this is the account of Noah and his family. Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time, and he walked faithfully with God. In Genesis 6:22, there's a really short verse. It's kind of one of those verses that you want to have whenever you're a kid in Sunday school and you have to memorize verses. This kind of verse you want to memorize. Noah did everything just as God commanded him. Significant, important, astounding verse. My question is this something that could be written about you? Let's just say somebody was writing the Bible part 2 right now. And they were, you know, living in Lewistown, and they were writing significant events worthy to make the Bible. Would your name be able to be written in there as that you did everything that God commanded you to do? We have to remember, when Noah was living, it said everybody else except Noah was evil continually. What does that mean? That means he didn't have a church to go to. That means he didn't have a prime group to go to. That means he didn't have a pastor that he could go to. He didn't have televangelists on TV. He was alone. It was him and God. He had no support, no backup. And I hope we all understand how important this group of people is to ourselves. Our prime groups, you know, that's what we build out relationships, and we encourage one another, and we have each other's backs, and we help each other, and I'm not sure Noah had that. I don't think he had that encouragement, that backup support whenever he was living. He was on his own as far as when it came to God. Now, we don't know if he, you know, was isolated from everybody. Maybe, you know, yeah, crazy old Noah over there on the farm, you know, that's maybe how they thought of him back then. But we know he didn't have any spiritual support here on earth. It was him and God. Without any Bible, now, that would be difficult. I mean, that would really be walking that faith, which is probably why we're talking about him today, is the huge amount of faith that he had. But I thought it was significant to point out that he was in this world by himself spiritually. What else do we know about Noah? Well, he had 3 sons. How do we know that? Because it says Noah had 3 sons. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And he had them. He had the first one at age 500. What was Noah's occupation? In Genesis 9:20, they call him, this is whenever he got off the ark, but they said Noah was a man of the soil. So I'm taking from that he's probably a farmer type of a guy, which in my mind makes the fact that he was assigned the task of building this monstrous vessel even more significant, because you would have thought God would have picked the carpenter, right? That's who Jesus was, basically. So man after God's own heart, a carpenter. No, I think he picked a farmer, and we're going to talk about the significance of that in a little bit. But let's just dwell on this. Some say that Noah was also a preacher. I'm not so sure. There's a lot of debate about what Noah did for those years while he was building the ark. Let's talk about Noah being a preacher. There's a lot of pastors out there that will use the story of Noah as a encouragement to other pastors that maybe are not seeing a lot of revival in their church. You know, maybe they're not seeing a lot of converts, or not seeing a lot of people come to Jesus, and they'll use Noah as a sermon to say, "Hey, Noah preached for 120 years and he got nobody." You know, well, I'm not so sure about that. If you get into the verses here. In Matthew 24:39, it states, "And they knew nothing." It's talking about the people in the time of Noah. "And they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away." They knew nothing about it, which sort of indicates that Noah wasn't telling everybody, "Hey, there's a flood coming. There's a flood coming. You need to come into the ark." Also, I think it says that, you know, God said it's going to be for you, your wife, and your sons and their wives. So I'm not sure if he was a preacher. The only thing that we can point to that says maybe he was a preacher is in 2 Peter 2:9 that says they called Noah a preacher of righteousness. That could have just been because his actions sort of portrayed what God wanted rather than him speaking it. But that's sort of a minor point whether Noah was a preacher or not. So that's a little bit about Noah. Let's go to the ark. 450 foot long, 75 feet wide, 45 feet high. Just know that 450 feet is basically a football field and then another half of a football field long. That's how long the ark was. And then 75 feet wide, that's wider than a football field. It's 50 yards, so that's not quite as wide as a football field. And then 45 feet high. In the Bible, it talks about cubits. That's what it's measured in. And if you read it, they're talking about cubits. There's a little bit of discrepancy about how big a cubit was, you know. But this is the common, what people would say is, the majority of people think this is the correct dimensions. And if you ask shipbuilders today about the ark, would that be seaworthy? Would that stay afloat? They say that shipbuilders say that these particular ratios would make it almost impossible for it to overturn. It's very stable. Not much to look at, but it's very stable. The way that it was designed was to stay afloat in mass storms. This may have been what the ark looked like. This is somebody's rendition of it. I'm not sure about all those great big gaps in there because that'd be a lot of wasted space. But anyway, you can sort of see the massiveness of the size of that ark. I mean, it was huge. There were no supply stores back then. There was no Lowe's. There was no Home Depot. You couldn't just go down to the hardware store or to the Home Depot and get all the lumber that you need and have it delivered and call the Amish guys up and have them come over and, you know, put up the frame for you like I did. You can't do that. You're basically like the Amish, where you have your tools, you had to know what you were doing. So I have to think that Noah, being a farmer, would have had to do a lot of praying back then, you know, as he was building this ark, I would think. If I were told to do that, I would have probably started laughing and then probably started crying and then started praying. So I think that's probably, put yourself in Noah's position there a little bit. Did you ever think about how much money it would have cost Noah to build this ark? He would not have been able to do his farming, which was his living, we think. He would have had to get all of this lumber, which would be a heck of a lot of lumber to get. Maybe he went and cut them all down. Maybe wood was free back then. I kind of doubt it with billions of people on the earth. Somebody owned something, and there was probably commerce back and forth, however he got that. But something I never really thought about before is the amount of money, the amount of faith monetarily that Noah must have had to invest everything that he had into this ark on dry land, by the way, not by the ocean, on dry land. he's building this big boat. Forgot about gopher wood. If you read in Genesis, it talks about gopher wood, or it might say, some of your translations might say cypress wood. Nobody really knows. The translation is actually gopher, and we're not sure if that's a tree that became extinct, whether that was another term used for the local trees around the area. We're not sure. So we call it gopher wood. And if you try to go find that at the store, good luck. Was the ark big enough? So this is a common argument for those that are not Christians, that don't believe in the whole flood and the ark thing. They're saying it is impossible for you to be able to fit all of the kinds of animals onto the ark. So the question is the ark big enough? Now remember, when it talks about two of each kind, that means we need two dogs, not two Shih Tzus and two German Shepherds and two poodles and whatever. It's two dogs, two cats, two elephants, that kind of thing. You get it. So let me read a little bit here. By the way, Sean always has cool-looking objects for you to remember what he's talking about, right? So I'm thinking about what object that's not. I thought about the fish. I could have this little fish. Nah, that's not big enough. But I thought, well, sometimes these lights go out and it gets dark up here. So I was going to wear this, especially with my old eyes. And then I thought, well, maybe this could be my object, searching for faith. So whenever you think of this lesson, you think of this object with a little light, and you can think of it as the searching for faith. By the way, out there in radio land, they're laughing like crazy. You probably can't hear them. They're laughing like crazy right now. Okay, the ark. Was it big enough? Let me read some stuff that I found. I thought it was pretty interesting. Was the ark big enough to hold all the animals? Available floor space is over 100,000 square feet. If you add up the amount of square footage on the ark, 100,000 square feet, that's equal to 569 railroad cars. And that's going to become pertinent here in a little bit when we talk about railroad cars. 569 railroad cars. According to Ernest Meyer, America's leading taxonomist, there are over 1 million species of animals in the world. However, the vast majority of these are capable of surviving in the water and would not need to be brought aboard the ark. Noah need make no provision for the 21,000 species of fish or the 600 echinoderms, including starfish and sea urchins, or the 107,000 mollusks, such as mussels, clams, and oysters, or the 10,000 coelenterates, like corals and sea anemones, jellyfish, and hydroids, or the 5,000 species of sponges, or the 30,000 protozoans of microscopic single-cell creatures. In addition, some of the mammals are aquatic. Whales, seals, and porpoises. The amphibians need not have been included, nor all the reptiles, such as sea turtles and alligators. The arthropods, numbering 838,000 species, such as lobsters, shrimps, crabs, and water fleas and barnacles, are also marine creatures. The insects are usually very small. Also, many of the 35,000 species of worms, as well as many of the insects, could have survived outside of the ark. So that narrows us down to how many animals we need to actually have on the ark. Dr. Morris, and if you've ever read, this is sort of the top book on the subject called The Genesis Flood by Morris and Whitcomb, state that no more than 35,000 individual animals needed to go on the ark. In his well-documented book, Noah's Ark, A Feasibility Study, John Woodmorap suggests that far fewer animals would have been transported upon the ark. By pointing out the word species is not equivalent to the created kinds of Genesis account. I'm starting to get into a little bit of nitty-gritty here, some details. But Woodmorap credibly demonstrates that as few as 2,000 animals may have been required on the ark. To pad this number for error, he continues his study by showing that the ark could easily accommodate 16,000 animals. But let's be generous, okay? Let's add on a reasonable number to include maybe some extinct animals. Then add on some more to satisfy even the most skeptical. Let's assume 50,000 animals. Far more than that's required. But let's just assume for now, 50,000 animals is what we needed to put on the ark. And you got to remember, there's some pretty big animals out there, but not a whole lot. There are some dinosaurs, and yes, dinosaurs, I think, were on the ark. You got some elephants, you got rhinos, we got some big ones. But that doesn't necessarily mean we had to take the adults, you know, the big ones. It could have took the babies as well. There would have been far less space. So I just told you there are very few large animals, such as the dinosaur or the elephant, that can be represented by young ones. Assuming the average animal to be about the size of a sheep, and using railroad cars for comparison, we know that the average double-deck stock car can accommodate 240 sheep. Thus, three trains hauling 69 cars would have ample space to carry the 50,000 animals, filling only 37% of the ark. This would leave an additional 361 cars, or enough to make five trains of 72 cars each to carry all the food and baggage plus Noah's family of eight people. The ark had plenty of space. So whenever you hear the argument, there's no way you can fit all the animals, all different kind of animals on the ark. Think of those kind of numbers. You know, you can eliminate all the aquatic animals, all the real insects. They probably stowed away. I'm sure he didn't do that on purpose. Okay. So think about if you were in Noah's position here and you were told to build this ark, and then God said, now I want you to get two of every kind of animal. And by the way, there are seven of some kinds of animals. They call them the clean animals. These are the animals that they could eat and do sacrifices with. For those kind of animals, they brought seven of them. But God told Noah, not only do you have to build the ark, but now you have to get two of each kind of animal into your ark. Say what? That sounds like a pretty massive ordeal. I mean, that sounds like a pretty big undertaking to try to get all the animals representative of each kind of animal onto your ark. That'd be another big faith moment in my mind for Noah, just to let that in God's hands. I'm going to say, okay, that's what you want me to do. And I have here, you know, I wonder if you tried to forget some of the animals. The snake, no. I remember Methuselah talking to great-great-great-grandpappy Adam, and he said, you're no good. So, but the snakes made it. The mosquitoes made it. I just wonder, maybe there were some animals that didn't make it. But I think we can all agree that all the animals made it onto the ark because it also says whenever the ark was full, that God closed the ark, the door of the ark, which kind of represented God said, now you're ready. You have everything that you need. Everybody is on board, is supposed to be on board. Everything is on board, is supposed to be on board. So God shut the door of the ark. So I don't think we can, as a sort of joking around, I can tell by your laughter that you understood that. But I don't think there was any animals that were supposed to make it that didn't, which would bring us to, I don't think that happened. And a lot of people think that's how the dinosaurs died, was during the flood. And it doesn't tell us that. It said two of every kind of animal. So I think the dinosaurs were on there. Okay, the flood. So the first question is, was the flood local or the whole earth? So let's talk about this. In Genesis 7, I believe, now what we're going to talk about here from here on is Scott's theory, which coincides with a lot of other people, by the way. But I'm not going to be very dogmatic and to say this is the way it was, because I wasn't there. I'm just going by what the Bible says. So let's just read what it says in Genesis. It says, they rose greatly on the earth, talking about the waters. And all the high mountains under the entire heavens were covered. The waters rose and covered the mountains to a depth of more than 15 cubits. Every living thing that moved on land perished. Birds, livestock, wild animals, all the creatures that swarm over the earth, and all mankind. Everything on dry land that had the breath of life in its nostrils died. Every living thing on the face of the earth was wiped out. People and animals and the creatures that moved along the ground and the birds were wiped from the earth. Only Noah was left, and those with him on the ark, or in the ark. So that would be my main reason for believing that the whole earth was covered, because basically every and all turned up a lot of times, and it seemed like the writer of Genesis took a lot of pains to make sure that you understood every, all mankind, all creation, all animals, everything that breathed, okay? But have you ever thought about 40 days of rain? 40 days of rain. It could rain 40 days. Do you think the whole earth would be covered with water with 40 days of rain? I don't. I mean, not the rains that we see, I don't think the earth would be covered with 40 days of rain. That's a lot of people say, 40 days of rain, well, yeah, that would cause some flooding, no doubt. But the whole earth, come on. You know, like the Himalayas and the Alps and stuff. Well, maybe you have heard about this, maybe not. But there's indications in the creation account that there was a water canopy around the earth. Back in Genesis 1, it says, "Then God said, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." Okay? We're going to put air in between. There's going to be water above, and there's going to be water bottom, water in the bottom. God made the expanse and separated the waters which were below the expanse from the waters which were above the expanse. And it was so. So you get that. There's earth. And before God did this, you know, way back in Genesis 1, it was all water. And then he separated. There's water above and there's water below. So the water below is on the earth and there's water above the earth. And in between is what our atmosphere basically is. So there's this water canopy up there. So you can see it was probably a very violent, I can almost guarantee, it was a very violent action that was going on there, where there was water that was beneath, you know, inside of the earth that came sprouting up, causing the tsunamis and that kind of stuff. But I also think that the water canopy that was above the earth just collapsed down on the earth. That water canopy probably did a lot of good things, which is probably may have had some reason why the people lived as long as they did. I think maybe that filtered out some of the cosmic rays and some of the, you know, the harmful rays that we get from the sun and from space. That water canopy was, you know, probably filtered out a little bit. I also think we're going to have to move a little faster here. We're going to, I think that the earth pre-flood, the pre-flood earth, was probably not like it is today. And there's a question whether there was even rain. Have you ever heard of that? Maybe there wasn't even rain until the time of Noah. We get that in Genesis 2, 5, and 6. It says, "Now no shrub had yet appeared on the earth, and no plant had yet sprung up, for the Lord God had not sent rain on the earth, and there was no one to work the ground. But streams, or a mist, came up from the earth and watered the whole surface of the earth." So there may have been no rain up to that point. Maybe it just happened, you know, this mist came up and watered the earth. We're not sure whether that happened all the way to Noah's time or not. But maybe there was no rain. Another instance is maybe there was no mountains. Mountains are what cause a lot of the turbulent storms and stuff that we have on the earth today. You know, whenever the, I don't know, I'm not a weather guy to know all that stuff, but it seems like that, you know, when warm air and cold air collide and they go up over mountains and stuff, that's where a lot of this turbulent stuff. So maybe the earth was a lot flatter than what it is right now as far as mountains go. No extreme weather that would go along with the mountains. And how many have heard of Pangaea? Pangaea is what we think of as maybe at one point in time, all of the landmass was together at one spot. One indication that we get from this is there's a guy named, well, in Genesis, it talks about the waters gathering into one place. And then that means correspondingly that the land would have had to been all in one place. But Pangaea sort of looks like this. Maybe. That's an artist's rendition of it. It kind of explains a lot of things, like how animals got to all the different parts of the world and how people got to all the different parts of the world. If Noah landed in one spot and everything's all separated, how would they get there? You know, those kind of questions. But there's one interesting, and maybe this is something new for you too, for you older Christians that have gone through the Noah story. There's a guy named Peleg or Peleg. A couple generations from Noah, two sons were born to Eber. One was named Peleg because in his time the earth was divided. His brother was named Joktan. If you were to take Peleg, and once again, this is another translation, it means to divide, split, or earthquake is what the name Peleg means. So if you think a couple generations after Noah, you know, there was a lot of, I'm thinking volcanoes and the earth was unstable and there was probably lots of earthquakes and stuff. And I think that may have been when the earth, you know, split up the way it is now. Who knows? Like I said, I'm not dogmatic about that. Just one of those. It's interesting that Peleg was called who he was because that meant divide, split, or earthquake. It's interesting that the earth returned to its original state. Whenever evil was over all the earth and God decided to wipe it out, he put it back to its original state. As we read in Genesis chapter 1, earth was covered with water. And I thought that was interesting that the earth went back to its original state. Okay. Here's a very quick, we're not going to spend a lot of time on this, timeline of Noah and the flood. You see Noah enters the ark. God shuts the door. The flood happens. It's only 40 days that the rain occurred. And then the rest was waiting for the water to recede when the dove went out, those kind of things. You can see, and it lasted approximately 377 days that they were on the ark. The new beginning. Once again, we can't have a story about Noah without the story of what was the symbol that God used to show that he's not going to flood the earth anymore. Rainbow, right, we all got that. So, did you know that the Hebrew word, I got three Hebrew words in here today. The Hebrew word for the rainbow was kwisheth, and it meant battle bow. If you know that rainbow, it kind of looks like, you know, a bow for an archer. And that battle bow being hung up in the clouds represented that we were no longer at war, and that God was retiring that weapon. And we know now that that is not probably how the ark looked, with everybody just out on the deck having a good time. But there's the rainbow. So here, finally, what can we learn? Let's get to the point. What can we learn from Noah? Our key verse today is in Hebrews. And if you weren't aware of this, Hebrews is what we're using to get down through the heroes of the faith here. And this was the verse about Noah. By faith, Noah built a ship in the middle of dry land. He was warned about something he couldn't see and acted on what he was told. The result? His family was saved. His act of faith drew a sharp line between the evil of the unbelieving world and the righteousness of the rightness of the believing world. As a result, now this is the message, and I never heard this before, but I thought this was pretty, that's why I picked the message for this. As a result, Noah became intimate with God. That brings us to our main point, which is obedience leads to intimacy. As Christians, we are to be striving to become, to know our God better, to become more intimate with God. That is our goal. And it tells us right here in the story of Noah that obedience leads to that. Here are some verses that kind of give us the same kind of indication. There was a time when Jesus was on the earth here, it's in the New Testament. As Jesus was saying these things, a woman in the crowd called out, "Blessed is the mother who gave you birth and nursed you." A mother and her child, especially, you know, in the nursing stage, there is nothing more intimate than that. And by the way, when we're talking about intimacy here, we're not talking about, hey, if I obey my wife, maybe we'll get a little intimate later. You know, that's not what we're talking about. If we were talking about that, we'd have a great big sign over here that was in neon red that said S*X, and the room would be packed probably. But we're not talking about that today. We're talking about an intimacy of you and your Savior together, knowing each other. That's what we're talking about. But a mother and their child, a mother nursing a child, it doesn't get much more intimate than that. But what does Jesus reply here? He says, he replied, "Blessed rather are those who hear the word of God and obey it." It is actually more intimate. You can become more intimate with God by hearing the word and obeying it, even more than what a nursing mother with her child would be. "If you love me, keep my commandments." How many times have you told that? If you love me, if you want to be intimate with me, keep my commandments. "Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say?" How can you say that you are intimate with me when you don't do what I say? See the relationship between obedience and intimacy. Obedience, intimacy. Jesus replied, "Anyone who loves me will obey my teaching. My Father will love them, and he will come to them and make our home with them." Make our home with them. Talk about intimacy. How do you get that? Obey my teaching. We're seeing this. Obey, intimacy. Obey, intimacy. So, the commands that we are supposed to obey, there's a bunch of them, right? There's a bunch of them. But it can all be narrowed down to basically two. And here's the verses that we use. Jesus replied, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first greatest commandment. And the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself." We've heard these verses before. And I think we've heard them so much that, yeah, we know. And we do that, right? We have prime groups, and we have times where we've gone to people's houses and helped them out. That's loving each other. And we come here on Sunday mornings, and we sing to God, and that's loving God. But I think there's more to that command than maybe we don't think about as much. And here in the last couple minutes, I'm just going to give you two ideas, two verses that talk about, this is your take-home homework, so to speak, of how to obey God's commands. We're going to talk about two. I mean, there are lots of commands, right? But there's only two verses. Love God, love others. Love God, love others. Love God, love others. If you do those, you're going to be on the right track. So the verse that I picked for loving God is this one. In the same way, let your light shine before others that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. That they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father. You can glorify your Father. You can love your Father. You can obey your Father by letting others see the light in you. By being the example. By not blending in, but standing out. Noah, I guarantee, stood out from his peers in Noah's day. Like I said, they probably called him crazy old Noah. But he stood out. And that verse that he did all that God commanded him. He loved God. And he stood out. And he let his light shine. Second one is love others. You're not going to like this one. This is a hard one. But we're all good at loving each other here, right? But what about this? But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. That's still loving others. That's hard to do. Loving your enemies. It's hard to not punch them in the face, rather let alone love them. So this week, an enemy isn't like the Joker and the Batman or your arch enemy. You know, it's somebody that maybe you've been friends for a long time and you're having a spat and right now you're arguing. Or somebody that you never really got along with. You know, it's not like you're out and out fighting, but you just sort of avoid them, you know. But this is saying, love your enemies and to pray for those who persecute you. You ever try praying for your enemy? Have you ever tried that? It's hard. But if you do that with a sincere heart, it makes it a lot easier to love them whenever you see them again. So that's it. Those are the two pieces of homework that you have as far as loving God and loving others. And I think when we're talking about how can I get close to God? How can I become more intimate with God? The answer is actually very simple. It's not very simple to do, but the answer is very simple. Obedience leads to intimacy. The verse that talks about Noah, it said he did all that God commanded him and he became intimate with God.